This is the River Radius, a cultural nexus of rivers, people, and boats. I am your host, Sam Carter. Welcome.
You know, what occurred was in 1955, and then in 1964, there were two 100-year floods, and there had been extensive logging, road building, clear cutting above some of the most finest redwood groves that presumably were preserved, and they were wiped out. The amount of debris and landsliding and water that came through just showed that if you're going to preserve redwoods, you have to preserve the watershed from the stream up to the ridgeline.
This episode is the second in a two-part series about the Emerald Mile, the book, the dory, and the source of it all, a stretch of old-growth redwood trees along a creek on the Pacific coast, the place known as the Emerald Mile. In this second episode, your host, Samara Rosen, continues to unravel the story of how a group of people still to this day are working amongst the stream and the forest of the Emerald Mile, protecting and nurturing some of the largest trees on the planet. Please welcome River Radius contributing host, Samara Rosen.
This episode comes to you from the question, was the Emerald Mile truly lost? In the last Emerald Mile episode, you heard from Kevin Fidarko, whose book, The Emerald Mile, was named after the Emerald Mile dory, which was named after a creek within Redwood National Park in Northern California. Here's the quote that inspired these episodes.
Each dory in Martin's fleet was named after a natural wonder that had been destroyed or irreparably impaired by the hand of human beings.
You also met Dave Vandemark, a photographer instrumental in the inclusion of the Emerald Mile within the park's boundaries. If you haven't already, I would recommend giving it a listen before diving into this episode. In this episode, we talk with park scientists about the demonstrated need to expand the park, a lobbyist who advocated for the park boundary expansion, and Dave Vandemark and his photography documentation project to ultimately grapple with our own definitions of conservation and if the Emerald Mile was truly lost. We'll begin this episode with a compilation of pertinent moments of the previous episode to prepare you for what happens next to the Emerald Mile.
In 1963, the National Geographic Society published an article in their magazine about the tallest trees that they have surveyed in the world. And those tallest trees occurred in Redwood Creek. The Emerald Mile is a stretch of Redwood Creek, basically in the heart of a remote national park, surrounded in a narrow valley on this beautiful stream with old growth on both sides of you. There was a gentleman who was instrumental. His name is Dave Vandemark. And Dave was working the system with Congress trying to get the Emerald Mile included in the national park.
And what happened next?
We created a park at that time.
Is this where you describe it as the worm?
Yes.
Can you walk us through why you called it that?
Just to protect 1/4 of a mile on either side, it's just virtually nothing. The worm is kind of an ugly word, and I think that was a good snide remark about how little protection Redwood Creek was being given by that narrow corridor.
So even after Dave Vandemark's thousands of miles and letters and photographs, how is the Emerald Mile lost at the hand of man?
So you had the 1/4 mile completely protected. There was a so-called 800-foot buffer that initially the timber companies weren't operating in, but they were just massively clear-cutting as much as they could, as fast as they could, down to that 800-foot buffer. And then they said, all right, now we're going to start cutting little patch cuts in that buffer right down to that original worm boundary. The thousands of acres of contiguous logging was just causing too much damage. The channel of Redwood Creek was filling up with gravels to where the gravels were almost coming to the very level of the tall trees grove itself. A horrendous storm of any kind could have just wiped it out. And so we lost the original forest, we lost the ecosystem because we were so short-sighted to look really ahead.
Now that we've recapped the highlights of the first Emerald Mile episode, we'll begin the second episode in earnest with two experts from Redwood National Park, whom you met briefly last episode, Vicky Izaki and Leonel Arguello, to review the park timeline and contextualize the subsequent desire to adjust the park boundaries.
So I'm Vicki Ozaki, and I'm now retired, but I worked for Redwood National Park for about 39 years. And I was hired initially as a physical science tech when I was in college, and I spent most of my time then 100% on Rubber Creek, surveying and looking at the effects of commercial timber harvest and road building and the effects of large floods on the channel itself. And then eventually I got a master's and was able to be hired as a geologist and worked there a long time.
My name is Lionel Arguello. I'm the deputy superintendent for Redwood National and State Parks on the national park side. This is my 35th summer at this park. And I originally was hired on as a student biotech. And I've been on with the park as a botanist and then as the veg manager, and then as the program manager for resources management and science, and now as deputy superintendent.
I'm thinking that it would be helpful to begin with an overview of some of the bills, and then we can dive a little bit deeper.
By 1968, Congress established Redwood National Park, locally called the Worm, because it looked like a worm on a map. If you could imagine just a green strip of national park on either side of Redwood Creek, all the way up to the Tall Trees Grove and inclusive of the Emerald Mile. And that is what was created in 1968. That was immediately unsatisfactory for most people who wanted a national park, because immediately after that establishment, the timber companies began to log the upper slopes above the worm. That logging was pervasive and pretty destructive to the Tall Trees Grove, for which this park was now newly established. And the threat comes from sediment, from large clear cuts, where those bare soils can mass waste into the streams, which then flow into Redwood Creek, which can deposit and fill in the creek itself, which is what we observed. So for a decade, there was a lot of effort at expanding the park.
Downriver is a river gear company based in Denver, Colorado, and they are hosting Raftopia this first week of April. Raftopia is Downriver's annual major river gear sale with new river gear and used gear. It begins on April 2nd and culminates on Saturday, April 6th with an outdoor parking lot sales event with many of your favorite river gear companies on site in person. I will be at Raftopia as well as the MC. Come on down and say hey, find great deals on river gear, and meet Rad River people. Raftopia is happening in Denver, Colorado on Saturday, April 6th. You can find Downriver Equipment online at www.downriverequip.com and in today's show notes. Our sponsor today is AED One-Stop Shop. An AED is the automatic external defibrillator that is a great tool for commercial river outfitters to have on their boats. Have you heard our episode, Heart Attack on the River, from January of this year? That episode and story share the value and life-saving potential of having an AED on your commercial riverboats. AED One-Stop Shop is working with the River Radius, providing a bulk order discount on their AED bundles right now that allows for complete deployment of AEDs throughout your river outfitting company. AED One-Stop Shop has been working with river outfitters for 10 years. To gain their bulk discount, use the link in the show notes, on our website, or in our Instagram link tree to hit the landing page for AED One-Stop Shop.
And to understand the drive to expand, let's talk a little bit about logging. Let's talk about what logging entails and how it impacts a watershed.
In the context of Redwood Creek and Redwood National Park, the logging was the wholesale clear cutting of lands, thousands of acres, in the old growth. You not only had the haul roads to haul the logs out, but you had landing beds. You had to be created. You can't just go out there with a saw and cut. These are 20-foot diameter trees. Essentially, when clear cutting was complete, you had basically this skinned landscape. So that's what logging was.
In like about mid-1950s, 80% of the basin was a coniferous forest, old growth redwoods, old growth Doug fir. But by 1978, there was a lot of logging that went on in Rubber Creek. Less than 20% of the original coniferous forest in Rubber Creek remained. So if you think about the commercial timber harvesting that was going on and the road building, forest practice rules were established in 1973. So if you can imagine, all this was done with no rules, just extensive disturbance. And there's even photographs of the old logging days, you know, where they they put log decks in the creeks. They had heavy equipment running right up the channels. So it's a really different time period. And when you look at it now, it's just really devastating to see those photos. You would never see the type of logging that was occurring in the park at that time today.
When we think about the functions that forests play in watershed health, I'm curious about the downstream impacts of logging.
You have the hill slope impacts of the roads, which causes landslides, the disruption of the natural drainage systems. They took out riparian zones. Riparian zones would normally be a buffer to the channels as far as sediment coming down, but there were none at the time. And the amount of sediment deposited from both the timber harvesting following and then following floods, that channel bed was just filled in with sediment.
Vicki, I've read your work over previous decades. Would you talk a little bit about what these impacts are, the implications, and why we care?
Currently, Railroad Creek is listed under the Clean Water Act as sediment impaired and temperature impaired. And that all translates back to this early history in the watershed of the logging and the large storm events. And we have threatened endangered salmon and steelhead in the river itself. And if you think about these impacts that occurred from the 54 to 78, and how many life cycles of salmon and steelhead that represents, you're talking about generations and generations of fish. And so that has a big impact to the whole aquatic ecosystem. And then not only that, but the temperatures in the channel were incredibly high, 86 degrees or higher in Fahrenheit for 30 days plus. You know, not a lot can survive in there, let alone fish. We don't have the riparian zone that used to exist there, the old growth trees that used to shade the channel. But we have a long way to go for recovery if you're looking at stream temperature. We're going to have to grow some trees.
Because the park only occupies the lower 40% of Redwood Creek, the inputs from upstream still will challenge the temperature conditions potentially. And with climate change, it ain't going to get any better.
We're seeing the lower part of River Creek dry up for a mile and a half. So that's going to be pretty catastrophic for the river if that's the new normal.
With all of these changes to the creek, how are the redwoods impacted?
The impacts on old growth range from just direct mortality through a landslide or debris torrent taking out old growth, or flooding and sediment deposit that would potentially choke and kill redwoods at the edge of Redwood Creek. I don't want to paint the picture that there are no redwoods on Redwood Creek. There are. So for a decade, there was a lot of effort at expanding the park.
So the park boundaries were failing to protect the resources they were created to protect and demonstrated the need for change. Around the same time, John Amadio formed the Emerald Creek Committee in 1972, a small group of students at Humboldt State University in Northern California, about a half an hour away from Redwood State and National Parks, intent on expanding Redwood National Park to include Emerald Creek. The launch began with a bake sale to raise money to produce an 8-page brochure to disseminate to Congress. They then collaborated with David Brower to write another publication to engage the nation on the issue, which put them on the map and enabled them to meet with environmental consultants of Jimmy Carter. This momentum set the stage for their lobbying work in Sacramento at the Board of Forestry to impose tighter requirements and Washington, D.C., using Emerald Creek Committee members as on-the-ground information and lobbyists. Here are a few stories from John's lobbying career and his relationship with Martin Litton. John, I'm wondering if you would introduce yourself and how you first got involved with the Emerald Mile.
Well, someone you interviewed on the Stand campaign, my dear friend Mark Dubois, often says, careful what you fall in love with. So I was someone blessed to be introduced to the Redwoods in my early 20s. Fell in love with them, and as part of other Redwood lovers, as other students, really, we worked over 5 years to protect Redwood National Park through a necessary expansion of its boundaries, taking it from what was a political compromise to ecologically sound boundaries. Now, that experience also became the gateway for what may be an accidental 50-year career as an environmental advocate, mostly managing river and land preservation campaigns, but also 30 years as a California state environmental official.
Have you read The Emerald Mile by Kevin Fidarko?
Oh, yeah. Hell of a book.
I want to talk about Martin Litton.
Oh, yes.
I'm hoping that we can ground it in your experience with him. But as much as you know around his relationship with the creek and how he got involved and why he named Adori after the Emerald Mile.
Martin had an illustrious history. One of the first environmental reporters and for very significant publications, and elevated a number of key environmental issues through his being a hard-nosed investigative reporter. Then he linked up with David Brower. You know, we're two of the key leaders in successfully stopping these two massive dams that would have put an end to the Grand Canyon. Martin also used his experience and skills in making the case for creating Redwood Park. You know, when he was a reporter, California was his beat. So, I mean, he knew it probably as well as anyone. He loved it undoubtedly as much as anyone. And he knew from the start that the political boundary was maybe the best that could be achieved at that time, but it was ecologically a disaster. When Martin heard about, you know, our efforts, he came up to kind of give us some support, maybe stiffen our backbone, he might say. And we were just like, oh my God, Martin Litton's here visiting us. Because he was bigger than life.
And so, as you said, you formed the Emerald Creek Committee. What was the goal of the committee?
To try and see if we could get Congress to include the remainder of Emerald Creek to the national park. You know, what occurred was in 1955, and then in 1964, there were two 100-year floods, only supposed to happen every 100 years. And there had been extensive logging, road building, clear cutting above some of the most finest redwood groves that presumably were preserved. And they were wiped out. The amount of debris and landsliding and water that came through just showed that if you're going to preserve redwoods, you have to preserve the watershed from the stream up to the ridgeline.
Could we define what lobbying is and what that groundwork looked like? What were you actually doing?
You are seeking to educate decision makers or media on the significance of an issue and why specific action is necessary to protect the public interest. At least for public interest lobbyists. I'll give you an example. You know, working back in Washington, the chairman of the House subcommittee, who was the ultimate champion on the park expansion, was Congressman Phil Burton from San Francisco. He, in a short 6-year period, he was responsible for preserving more public land than anyone since Teddy Roosevelt. He was simply a political genius. And he was also a champion of labor. Quick backstory, he decided to have a congressional field hearing on his bill to expand the park by 74,000 acres, the biggest proposal, and to do it up in Eureka, the very heart of Redwood Country. I had been down and went to the airport, and it turns out Phil was on the same plane up to Eureka. And I introduced myself, and he said, "Sit with me, kid." And on the way up, he drank a couple double scotches, insisted I do, and he just drained me of any information he thought that could be useful to him. We got off. I was a little wobbly. There was the press there. He had not just absorbed, but made such a, you know, compelling case why the park expansion was essential, why the concerns over, you know, local jobs could be addressed, and he would make sure they were addressed. And, you know, then went on for a field tour and held a hearing, which was more of a riot than a hearing. The timber companies literally closed down their mills that day, so there could be a protest march of several thousand people and just jammed the hearing hall. You know, there was a handful of us there as pro-park expansion witnesses. They did a classic, I mean, out of a B-grade mob movie, where they stationed a couple of really tough-looking guys on each end of where we were clustered, and they would try and get your attention and make it really clear that they wanted to do you harm. And, you know, it was pretty intimidating. Burton was our hero. We would go see Phil every night to get guidance on how we could best approach whoever we were meeting with the next day. And he had already given us the list of who we should be meeting with. And like on one member, Representative Lamar Gudger, kind of the classic Southern congressman from North Carolina, had a lot of timber industry in his district. And Phil said, look, you got to be real gentle with Lamar. You want him to understand this wasn't a close call. This was a national park that was being destroyed. And this was some of the worst logging they could do, way different than what happens in his district. So we told the story through Dave Vandermark's photos. It must have been aerial photos taken about the time the park was created that just showed a blanket of old growth. It was just like, oh, you just wanted to be in that forest. And then we showed the next picture, which was now. And you can see these, it says small clear cuts, 40 acres, alternating. They look like teeth cutting right down to the park boundary. And you can just see he was visibly moved. He came on board. The other example was somebody who Phil said, he's not going to be easy. Democrat, he's got a suburban Maryland district, got a lot of labor. That's going to cause him pause for getting on board on something that they were opposed. First, make your case as logically as you can, seeking a clear commitment. If he really fails to come across at the end, you need to just make it just straight up political. You know, you have to basically say, Congressman, this is our number one national issue. We can't save this park. None of the parks really can be safe. Unless you're willing to support us, we cannot again support you for your reelection. So he came on board. So, you know, that's the type of effort you're involved in, tailoring your case to what you knew about the member.
And it seems incredibly helpful that Phil Burton was an advisor in this, kind of knew the ways of working with people, kind of the art of manipulation, if manipulation could be used with a positive spin on it.
He once told me, people think I get done what I do by breaking people's arms, because he was tough and he could get in your face if need be. But he said, no, that's not what I do. I find out what they want and I get it for them. So one of his ways he really preserved land was opponents called it park barrel. He would go to members and say, what's in your district that you would like to have funding for? Okay, I'll put it in my bill, but you have to support the whole bill. And the whole bill would include some of the more significant national, more controversial parks.
In thinking cross interviews, like the episode that we published on the Stanislaus, the pork barrel was seen as this terrible thing because that in a lot of ways is how New Melones was forwarded. But in this case,
this wasn't pork barrel. This was park barrel. It took the approach of pork barrel into something in which Phil was putting in parks, recreation areas, monuments, things that benefited the public.
Pork versus park barrel.
Yeah.
In terms of imagining your work, I really appreciate that you brought us into the world of lobbying. Are there other stories or firsthand experiences that you want to share about what it's like in the world of dealing with representatives?
Well, I'll tell you one. The industry thought, okay, we're going to do a cross-country convoy of timber trucks carrying a few of these massive redwoods. And we're going to have one of the redwoods carved into the shape of a peanut.
Why a peanut?
Jimmy Carter. He was a peanut farmer before he became president. So they would have this convoy going across country, stopping in different cities, holding rallies, you know, trying to make the case that it may be peanuts to you, but it's jobs to us. We knew where they were going, and we would send information ahead to the local media saying, you know, well, we always empathize with the loss of jobs. Seeing these trees is unlike anything imaginable. Of course, we have to protect that park, you know, through expansion. We also knew that they were going to visit all of the 535 members of the House and the Senate and present a little redwood seedling and try and have that as a basis. We may be cutting these massive millennial old trees, but don't worry, because we're replanting. And we actually had a sympathizer who worked in the Louisiana Pacific nursery where they were growing these little redwoods, who shipped us back enough seedlings so the day before they arrived and can make their rounds, we went to every Congress office and we made the case about the difference between a redwood seedling and preserving your redwood heritage. And so these poor folks, they would go into an office, have their seedling, and say, oh yeah, we got one of those several days ago. Slightly different message though. So, you know, you try and have some humor where you can and do something different that catches people's imagination.
The best kind of organizing. It's out of the box and unusual, and it makes people think. In thinking about the way that we're talking about the timber industry and the employees, I'm curious if the relationship that they had to your work and to conservationists was the same across the board, or if there was any sympathizers.
They were in the hardest spot. I mean, this was their livelihood that they feared was on the line. We never felt angry towards the loggers. You know, we knew that the enemy was the timber corporations. We were just liquidating old growth to maximize profit. And that these same loggers who they were saying expansion is going to destroy your future, you know, were rapidly reducing the labor force through automation and, you know, reduced forest to log. And so it was a mixed bag. I mean, mostly they felt that they had to oppose the park, but we would occasionally get tips from somebody who was working for them. The other important part is, remember, Phil Burton was probably the top most effective champion for labor in the House at that time. And he came up with something that was completely innovative. Basically, he provided a set of benefits that recognized not only should the corporate shareholders be compensated for the loss of the trees, the loggers and the labor whose jobs were being displaced for public purpose of preserving a national park, they should, you know, be compensated. And so he put in the most generous benefits ever for a public taking. And it was so unprecedented that when President Carter signed the bill, and he had to make a distinct point in saying, in signing this bill, we are no way endorsing this approach to compensating for lost jobs, because it was the most expensive. But Phil was the guy who equally championing each of these, which really became the thing that ultimately softened labor's opposition and left the corporations pretty much standing alone in opposition. And there was another element, innovative element of the bill that sought to soften the impact. This was something that Senator Alan Cranston, the senior Democratic senator from California, like Phil, a strong conservationist, but at least equally a strong pro-labor guy, we were able to present to him, and this is where local knowledge was critical, to say, look, much of this area we're acquiring is a park for the future. It needs active restoration work, and therefore there should be some significant funding for watershed restoration. And Cranston liked that, and he put in as part of his requirement $33 million, which in today's dollars is, you know, closer to like $300 million, as the largest watershed restoration program ever federally funded. And it was designed to try and employ as many of displaced loggers as were interested and could be utilized. It literally spawned a national watershed restoration movement because it was the first time there was that amount of money and they could learn as they went as to what was effective.
What was the ultimate result?
You know, we relied on Phil to cut the best possible deal. His bill was originally 74,000 acres. Carter administration came in with something much smaller. And that's where, again, local knowledge became invaluable. Because, you know, we who knew that area best, including with people like Dave Vandermark, we could say, well, here's the absolute minimal the park should be expanded. And we were saying, pat in the worm, you need to go up to the ridgeline and you need to add 4 more miles of Redwood Creek upstream so you encompass these other incredible watersheds. You know, we pushed for and advocated the 48,000 acres, and that was what was adopted by Phil and moved forward. When it came time for the final vote, all standing at the doors to the House chambers where lobbyists would usually stand to, you know, give a thumbs up or thumbs down as a signal to members with whom they had relations, and all our thumbs were up. And so it just sailed through the House, had a bit of a tougher time in the Senate, but it also passed there sufficiently.
Thus, in 1978, the park doubled in size from just over 50,000 acres, which includes the Redwood State Parks, to over 100,000 acres. Less than a quarter, however, of the newly added lands were old-growth redwood forest.
If I'm totally honest, when I learned that the park was expanded, I had trouble wrapping my head around the value of protecting an ecosystem that had already been partially logged and inundated with sediment. In the back of my mind, I kept hearing Dave say,
"We're talking about thousands of years to bring back an old-growth forest environment."
I have the impression that the struggle to value degraded landscapes is relatively common, and sometimes even intentional. Take, for example, a short side conversation I had with John Amadio.
As we got to our grove, we could see where they were logging just across from the North Fork. And what this told us, and we should have known because it had happened before, is that once you elevate a place as special that is worthy of preservation, that puts a target on it. And the industry quite purposefully does their best to make it less special by logging it as fast as possible.
Today's episode is sponsored by AED One Stop Shop. Are you a river guide or a river outfitter? Are you looking for AEDs at a good price? AED One Stop Shop has been a vendor member of the American Outdoors Association Conference for 10 years, supplying AEDs to river outfitters. AED One Stop Shop is providing a bulk order discount on their AED bundles right now, which includes the Heart Sign Samaritan AED, which is 2.4 pounds and the most tolerant to dust and water, some trauma shears, gloves, a shaving razor, and a protective carrying case for on-water transport. To gain this discount, use the link in the show notes on our website or in our Instagram link tree to hit the landing page for AED One Stop Shop. Downriver Equipment is a river gear shop, and the co-owners are river people, and they work at the shop every day. When you engage with the people at Downriver, you are working with river runners who have experience with your questions, or they will find the person in-house who can get you the best answer. And Downriver welcomes the new river runners, the folks who are starting at the beginning. All of your questions are important. Downriver is hosting Raftopia in this first week of April. Raftopia is their annual major gear sale loaded with new and used gear. Raftopia culminates on Saturday, April 6th with an outdoor parking lot sales event. You can find Downriver Equipment online at www.downriverequip.com and in today's show notes.
Around this same time, a professor at Oregon State University shared with me a resource management framework that seeks to outline three approaches to stewarding irreversibly changed ecosystems. The framework is called the RAD framework, which stands for Resist, Accept, Direct. Resist alludes to actively resisting change through restoration. Accept allows ecosystems to shift into new states with unknown consequences, and direct facilitates transformation directed at specific ecological characteristics. The RAD framework helped me understand the long-term vision of restoring ecosystem functions rather than irreplaceable thousand-year-old trees. Here's Lionel and Vicky to break down the Redwood Expansion Act and what it meant in practice for the conservation of Redwood National Park.
The Expansion Act was promulgated in 1978. It provided for additional land base to protect the slopes, the hill slopes above Redwood Creek, and all of the groves that the worm was attempting to protect. Very importantly, Congress promised up to $30 million to reverse some of the impacts of the logging on the new lands that were acquired. The resource management program then started focusing on how do we get rid of these roads? How do we protect the aquatic ecosystems? What are the techniques and tools available to us to begin a program of restoration? The third one I just wanted to highlight is that it gives authority for parks to look outside of park boundaries to protect parks from influences that might occur on neighboring lands. It didn't authorize us to challenge anything, but it gave us the authority to comment.
It was really unusual, but as part of that legislation, the Congress said you are mandated to study erosion and sedimentation, both human and natural, in that watershed. That is what allowed us to do the decades of research that we did. Part of that process of trying to figure out what's going on River Creek, one of the first things we did was a sediment budget. What's the source of sediment? Where is it in the channel and how much is going out? It was a way for us to look at what is preventable. What can we actually work on? And from that, those studies and that work, basically, our take-home message was you need to prevent the sediment from reaching the channel. And the way to do that is you treat the roads and you remove them or you upgrade them.
I know that it's scale specific, but when you think about the rate of movement of sediment through a watershed, how long do you expect it to take for a reasonable proportion of the sediment from the logging to work its way out to sea?
It's been a process of flushing from the headwaters out. What's interesting is when we were working in the headwaters in the 80s, there were old growth dug fir riparian zones that were buried up to 25 feet in sediment. And then subsequent floods were flushing that material down the channel itself. You know, 25 feet, that's like a two-story building. You know, 20 to 30 years later, we realized that we were sitting on top of 15 feet of fill. It was pretty amazing to work in a basin where you can see a channel recovery over time like that.
Now, you have seen a number of projects in a lot of the area. I'm wondering if you could talk about some of the projects that you've worked on, the rationale for why they were implemented, and what's happened.
The rationale for all of our restoration points back to the Expansion Act. From the very top of the ridge, oak woodlands and grasslands are burned. We do invasive plant management. We do conifer fuels reduction. We prescribe fire in those systems because they're quite adapted. Going downhill, downstream, we encounter all of that second growth forest. Second growth forests are forests that are recovering from all of that logging, that rampant logging. Because we were not managing those clear cuts, in our environment here, which is very humid, very wet, a full forest grows back in. It's a very dense forest at that age class. There's still not conditions that are conducive to habitat for all of the wildlife, all of the terrestrial species that might utilize old growth. So we have a program of restoration within these forests in order to create canopy gaps, in order to create spacing, and in order to reinvigorate understory vegetation development in the short term, in order to provide for habitat and protect the waterways. Long term, we're looking at accelerating the development of old growth characteristics. And we're doing this right now under the guise of a program called Redwoods Rising that has done compliance on 43,000 acres of state and national park lands to do forest thinning in Redwood National State Parks. Then there's the rotary wall, mid-slope, very steep. And when they fail catastrophically. In 97, we had a 12 and a half year return interval storm, which was, you know, a lot of rain, but not anything where near the 75 storms or the 60 storms or the 50 storm. And it launched 91 debris torrents, small landslides, major crackings in roads. It was a pretty heavy toll on the park. And so what we're afraid of is if we don't remove these roads out there, the next big storm is just going to create havoc for the recovery of Redwood Creek and all of the good work that's been happening with the flushing out of sediments. So those are the major restoration projects going on within Redwood National State Parks. It's focused on protecting aquatics, recovering better second growth forest, and removing these miles and miles and miles of roads that are threatening the park's terrestrial and aquatic ecosystems.
And it makes sense that you're striving towards a forest that mimics the functions and aesthetics of an old growth forest. I'm curious about the riparian equivalent of that. How do you create a functioning channel or watershed?
Yeah, so as part of Redwoods Rising, we had an opportunity to start stream restoration. So we actually collected stream watershed data to try and identify what's missing from the ecosystem. One of the things that was very apparent was the lack of large wood on the natural parklands. Why do we put wood in the channel? Basically, water is just flowing straight down that channel. So we need some velocity breaks, right? So fish coming upstream to spawn, they need some velocity breaks in there to take a rest. It creates shelter. It scours pools. It has lots of functions. So you're restoring a process that doesn't exist there. So I worked on a project to place extremely large wood in the channel and working with the Yurok tribe. They're an amazing local resource. They know a lot about stream restoration and have done a lot of large wood projects. The Yurok tribe placed 50 pieces of ginormous wood is pretty impressive work, and it has really changed that channel.
Old growth forests, they take hundreds of years to grow. And if you log that, that ecosystem has changed for an incredibly large amount of time. But when you think about conservation, if it's not going to be the same, what is the goal? And I hear you saying it's about helping it come back to its own processes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the idea. We're setting up for self-sustainability, not necessarily trying to recreate some vignette of the past that cannot be recreated because conditions have changed. We look back at the old growth as a reference potentially, but what we're looking at is short-term creating habitat and structure, and then long-term to have our system be self-sustaining progress towards some mature dynamic condition that will be beneficial to the resources that utilize these parks and to the visitors who come to the park.
How do you measure the effectiveness of the work that you're doing?
So I have a side story. In the 50s, there were landowners in the Mill Basin that said that the banks were covered in these freshwater mussels. And people working in the creeks never saw these freshwater mussels in River Creek. And then I think in the late 2000s, around 2008-09, our fish biologists found an actual mussel bed in River Creek. And they are significant because they're great indicators of water quality. And they live a long time. Like I think some live up to 100 years. So the fact that you can have a freshwater mussel that lasted through all of this sediment and temperature and everything is pretty amazing. And every year they find more and more beds. I even found one or found an existing one. It's pretty amazing. The critters in the streams, their resilience is really exciting. It's really amazing in the recovery of River Creek.
And I have one other side story. The story is that we are removing roads and unburying streams that have been buried for 50 years through sediment. Of course, buried streams are habitat for nothing other than maybe some invertebrates. But within a year after, we had coastal cutthroat trout in that recovered stream that was buried for 50 years. And they were spawning in that stream for the first time in 50 years. So these efforts are having tangible benefits in the immediate sense. That's why we're spending a lot of time, effort, and funding to restore these systems.
These are great examples of seeing the impact of the work that you have done over the last few decades. I want to return back to The Emerald Mile, the book by Kevin Fidarko, because I want to read a passage. Kevin Fidarko writes, "And for the special boat that spawned all the rest, the one whose lines had served as the blueprint for everyone that followed, Lytton selected perhaps the most beautiful name of all. It was a gesture of remembrance in honor of a dense and towering stand of continuous old-growth redwoods tucked deep in the coastal forests of Northern California, an entire mountainside mantled in some of the tallest virgin trees in the world, until a chunk of it was clear-cut during the early 1960s by a logging company that was hoping to disqualify the grove from inclusion in a national park. Truly something to cry about," Lytton had declared at the time. And so she became the Emerald Mile. I want to ask you, Martin Lytton was operating under a very different understanding of the status of the Emerald Mile back in the 1960s, 1970s. But it's been many decades now, and my question for you is it yet another vanished wonder? Was this ecosystem, this watershed, truly lost?
It's a story yet to be told. Redwood National Park protects the area that Martin Lytton was talking about. The plan for that area is recovery where clear cut has occurred and removal of any of the threats that would cause additional damage. But we're talking about a long-term recovery for old growth, maybe 150 to 200 years to recover trees consistent with the existing old growth. And we just don't have an idea of what climate change and other processes might wreak. So I would say that the Emerald Mile, as it exists on the river, is not lost. It's protected. Although I will say a lot of old growth was lost. And so when you look at the big picture, ridge to ridge, it is a sad story. And when you see the photos of Dave Vandermark, it guts you when you look at the way that those hill slopes were treated, and we're dealing with the after effects. And we hope that the work that we're doing in the park is having a measurable positive impact for the long term.
Maybe for Martin Lytton, it was a vanished wonder in the terms of that it was an old growth basin, maybe at the time he saw it. So that definitely is a lost wonder. But I kind of feel like watersheds can be resilient as long as you are putting protections in place. And when I think about River Creek itself, the lower section is protected by the park in perpetuity. So the egregious things that happened way back when will never happen again. And the park is doing its best to protect and conserve those resources and to monitor and see what's going on in River Creek itself. Yes, it's a story yet to be told, but I think it's also this kind of story of recovery, you know, like with the freshwater mussels that we're seeing. And all rivers change over time. They're not locked in space. And so it depends on what your measure is of what's lost, I guess. At least on the parklands, we will regrow big riparian trees and the forest will recover on its own in its own time. The creek is looking pretty good. A lot of the sediment from the 64 floods, 70s floods, are in the very lower rivers still being pulsed out. But a lot of the photos that Dave Vandermark is showing, you know, from his current project, really are great examples of the recovery of the channel itself to a former bed elevation. But the recovery of the bed elevation is just one metric of many to describe what recovery is. And the park has worked hard to be in the arena of regulations of changing forest practice rules to protect our watershed. But those rules have never been tested by a big flood. So we haven't been able to test how good those forest practice rules. They're way, way, way better than they were before. But that's the true test. And then we'll know how resilient River Creek is.
I repeated this question of if Martin Litton had indeed named the Emerald Mile after a place that had been lost. First here is John Amadio.
I mean, some of the places he named after places that were lost. And he may have considered the Emerald Mile lost as one rationally would have before the park was expanded. Because if the park wasn't expanded, you know, that little skinny quarter mile wide worm just would have collapsed on itself. It was in the process of being lost probably when he named it.
Would you say that the Emerald Mile was lost?
No. It was encroached upon. You know, there's still areas that are intact from the ridge down to the creek. And now 50 years later, there's a lot of recovery occurring.
And here is Kevin Fidarko.
You know, I'm of two minds about that. I mean, Martin used to say that the thing about conservation that makes it particularly difficult is that the people who are environmentalists, conservationists, defending nature can only afford to lose once. Because once you lose a special place, once a special place has been invaded by a mine or drowned by a dam or poisoned by toxic waste, we will never get it back. It's gone forever. And there's something particularly unfair about that because the folks on the other side are the conservationists. They can just keep coming back again and again and again. They can afford to lose as many times as it takes in order to get to that one victory. I think all that's true. But it's only true within the context of a human timescale. That's a pretty small aperture through which to look at the world and interpret it. If you shift your timescale away from the 21st century and you start looking at land through geologic time, you begin to realize that none of these places are lost. They're just lost to us. Maybe that's important. Because when we lose them to us, we lose something really important about not just where we've been and who we are now, but what we might become. There are certain people out there, and I'm one of them, who believe that like beauty is one of the lodestars that guides us. And when we sacrifice it or throw it away, we're adrift. But ultimately, the planet will probably be fine.
Dave, however, is still in the process of answering this question. Here, we come full circle to the moment I met Dave in Northern California.
Well, what we're doing today is the park folks that guided us down to where we're standing know that I'm going to take a major trip down the gorge of Redwood Creek and had planned to take off from a service road to access Redwood Creek, and they thought that there was a slightly easier route to at least half of it. And so that's what they were doing today, guiding us down through oak woodland on an old trail until we're standing now above open prairie and can see down into the Redwood Creek Canyon. And from there, we'll just follow a main ridge right down to the river.
Dave invited John Amadio and several others for the final stretch. Here's John's account.
First, Dave, who did the iconic photographs in establishing and then expanding Redwood Park, he decided that 50 years later would be a good time, as he approached 80, to do a retrospective. And he did most of that over the previous 2 years. And now the last remaining portion, was the most upstream portion, beginning at Devil's Creek, going through the most challenging part called Rocky Gap, and could require a hellish portage around super steep, poison oak-covered slopes, and then down into the Emerald Mile Tall Trees Grove. He organized a small group, feel very blessed to be invited on the group, to go hopefully 5 days with a 6-day built-in food-wise if necessary, to photograph as much as we could to document changes. And as Dave has noted, it was the hardest trek he's ever done, for me as well, probably because he's 80, I'm 74, but it would have been hard even when I was younger.
Could you bring us in? What is it like?
First of all, to get to the creek, there's no trails at this portion of Redwood National Park. To enter, you have to go down 1,800 feet of very steep grass-slick prairie. I quickly found out that did not prepare my legs for just how brutal this was going to be, thighs turning to jello, quivering and falling and all of that. If it wasn't that we had two superb backpackers, Kristen and blank, I can't go blank. This guy was, we called him God the first day because he ended up taking Dave and my pack down the last quarter mile because we were done in. And that was day one. I had tweaked my knee. The fifth person was a 78-year-old retired pediatrician in superb shape. And he said, seemed like you tore your meniscus. Day two, we had these very lightweight inflatable kayaks, and a shout out to Alpaca Raft who loaned them to us so that we could put gear in it and float down. We quickly learned we were going to have to portage a number of areas because either the water was too shallow or it was too narrow to get through. None of it was easy because if you were walking with backpacks or leading rafts through shallow areas, it's all really jaggedy cobblestone, wet stuff that you could slip on. Or when you were portaging, it was even harder because there was nothing flat and you were climbing over logs and very unstable rocks. We would stop so Dave could take photographs, but there wasn't any leisure time. Every day was full on, early on to as long as you could, figuring out how to get down the creek. Day five was the biggest challenge. That's when we got to Rocky Gap. And I remembered Rocky Gap from 4 years earlier when it was a lot of fun. Well, now 50 years later, and this is good, the healing has occurred. The stream channel was now lower by 8 feet or more. It was a narrow stream bed, much harder to navigate. And we came to places that we didn't know how we were going to get through them. It took some serious studying. And so Max was the other young guy. And Max spends about half his time bushwhacking in old growth redwood. So he was really skilled. We ended up that day spending 9 to 10 hours doing 10 portages.
Oh, no.
To go less than 1.2 miles.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, yeah.
After the expedition, Dave sent me PDFs of his photographs, annotated with arrows and comments about the changes over the last 50 years. In the margins, he reveals what he experienced. Here's one of his comments. Quote, "These groves were in grave danger of being invaded by damaging gravels in the 70s, but now the river is flowing more than 20 feet down from the grove level, a remarkable change. I teared up again here, as I'm always overwhelmed with emotions whenever I make it to, quote, my grove, as I always feel it may be the last time. I was so glad, as I made my way out to the river, that I felt I got a nice photo," end quote. Here's Dave on what happens next. When I asked you if you had stayed engaged since the creation of the park, you then talked about your involvement in the expansion. And following the expansion, what has your involvement been? And what about your photography?
Oh, I'm still doing it. I'm a little slow, and I'm enjoying this idea of trying to revisit places that I photographed 50 years ago. But I have to admit, I am encountering more difficulty getting to more places that I had hoped to get to, simply because of not only my physical condition at my age, but because the good and the bad of it, the Park Service, there's thousands of miles of logging roads that they're trying to restore back to a natural configuration. Well, if some of those things existed, I'd be able to get around a little better. So the whole idea of restoring the park is actually working to my detriment. But there are still a lot of places, and I'm still having a good time at it. And my project's supposed to end in December of this year, but I've already mentioned it to people, and they say, you can go on another year. So it probably will. I'll need it.
It takes somebody incredibly special to stand up and to recognize the beauty in a place, to hear that you have been devoted to this place for decades. Thank you.
What better place to be devoted for? The most magnificent forest growing on earth, or and what's necessary to protect them is what you need to be doing.
An old-growth redwood-sized thank you goes out to Vicky Izaki, Lionel Arguello, John Amadio, and the members of the Emerald Creek Committee, legislators and scientists who work towards the park expansion. Thank you again, Dave Vandermark, Kevin Fidarko, and Martin Litton, for your words that inspire conservation. And thank you, Matthew Brown, for the idea to tell this story. As always, you can find more resources in our show notes and on our social media page. I'm Samara Rosen. Thank you for listening to the River Radius podcast.
Thank you to Samara Rosen and all of her guests for this dive into the interweaving stories of all of the Emerald Miles. You can find out more about Samara at her website, readingwater.org. We have two sponsors today, Downriver Equipment and their Raftopia event. Raftopia is happening all of this week, culminating on Saturday, April 6th, online and in person. Our second sponsor is AED One Stop Shop, providing volume and outfitter discounts on AEDs. Use the link in the show notes and on the sponsor page of our website. All River Radius social media is organized by Samantha Seiss. All River Radius music comes from the lap steel guitar of Gene Reiniger. Be in touch anytime. hello@theriverradius.com. Thanks so much for joining the River Radius.
And my relationship with rivers is monogamous.
When Martin heard about our efforts, he came up to kind of give us some support, maybe stiffen our backbone, he might say. And we were just like, oh my God, Martin Litton's here visiting us. Because he was bigger than life.
I became known as Mr. Redwood. You know, I didn't have a relationship because I loved trees more than girls.
And those tallest trees occurred in Redwood Creek on a little alluvial flat that had this grove of immense voluminous redwoods.
So the fact that you can have a freshwater mussel that lasted through all of this sediment and temperature and everything is pretty amazing. And every year they find more and more beds. I even found one, or found an existing one.